Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to those people on the left coast. My name is Simon Barrett. I'll be honest with you. When I hear the name Casey Anthony, I cringe. There seems to be no end to this case. It just rambles on and on. The latest developments are that Casey has filed for bankruptcy and an appeals court has overturned two of the four guilty verdicts concerning her ability to not quite tell the truth to law enforcement. In an attempt to understand the significance of these developments, I have two guests joining me today. Well-known LA-based attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Simon. It's a pleasure to be back on.
And we're also joined by Orlando journalist Dave Neckel. Dave has followed the Casey saga from day one, and there are few people I can think of that know more about this case than Dave. In fact, he even suffered through the entire trial phase, sat on a wooden bench in the courtroom. Dave, welcome.
Hello, Simon. Hello, Peter. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate this. And I did sit through a lot, I'll tell you.
Okay, these latest developments, the appellate court ruling and the bankruptcy, I have a naturally suspicious mind, and I do see a bit of a connection. But before I get to that, let's deal with them separately. Peter, you read the appellate court's ruling. What did you make of it?
Well, what I made of it is that at the end of the day, the appellate court, this whole process of the appeal and the appellate court's ruling really didn't change too much the outcome of the criminal trial below. As everybody knows, the criminal trial did not result in a conviction for murder, which was the big ticket item. But she was convicted on four misdemeanor accounts. Casey Anthony was four misdemeanor accounts of providing false information to authorities in the course of the investigation. And these are documented in the appellate court opinion, and it makes for good reading. And it's strange to see the degree to which this woman doesn't tell the truth. And as you read the opinion, you get the sense that there's something pathologically wrong with her in terms of her ability to be honest and straightforward. But at the end of the day, the appellate court said, yeah, you convicted her of four offenses, but there really weren't four offenses. There were really only two. She may have made four separate untruthful statements to police, but she made them on two separate occasions, and these two separate occasions each constitute an individual offense, and therefore we only find that she can be guilty of two misdemeanor counts of providing false information under the statute in question, as opposed to four. And that's all the appeal accomplished. It reduced four misdemeanor counts conviction to two misdemeanor accounts, and that's it.
Okay, Dave, you obviously have read the ruling, and there's something that genuinely bothers me. It seems as if you know, it's okay to lie to the cops as long as you're not in custody and have not been read your Miranda rights. And that's my take, anyway.
I know that I put up a video of her in jail when she was first incarcerated, and her brother asked her if she was read her Miranda rights, a warning, and she replied, yes, she was. Now, that was never an issue over during this appeal, whether she really was or wasn't. But in the end, it was double jeopardy, I cited on an article that I wrote four different individual police officers, investigators, that she lied to. So, to me, that would be four separate charges and convictions, obviously, because she was, you know, invariably, or she was convicted of those charges. Two were tossed, and it was based on double jeopardy. But I still find that she lied to if a person lies to every cop that comes down the pike, I don't see how that could be one charge, for example. And in the end, it wasn't. I don't understand really quite clearly why the appellate court ruled the way it did on double jeopardy. Perhaps,
well,
Peter, about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. And also, if you want, talk about the thing that Simon just talked about, which is the notion that she can lie whenever she wants as long as she isn't in custody or under arrest. And there are really two separate issues here, and oftentimes when we read these types of opinions, these issues get mushed together, but there are two separate issues here. When they appealed the criminal conviction, they sought to toss out the statements. The defense team sought to exclude from the jury the statements of the police saying, in effect, this is the lie that she told me, this is the lie that she told me. The defense sought to suppress that evidence. And they sought to suppress that evidence on the grounds that they alleged that when she made these statements to police, she had not been properly Mirandized. She had not been advised of her Miranda rights. And Miranda rights, for people who don't know, come from a very important United States Supreme Court case called Miranda. And in effect, this case comes from the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and it says that you cannot be compelled to testify against yourself. So if the police are interrogating you and they haven't given you your Miranda rights, if they haven't told you that you don't have the right, you have the right to remain silent, that's one of the Miranda rights. If they don't properly give you Miranda rights while they're interrogating you, then a statement that you make to them after the point in time when you should have been given your rights, that statement is inadmissible. And that was one of the arguments on the appeal, that the conviction should be overturned because the statements were inadmissible because she wasn't given Miranda rights. And the Supreme Court said, no. You only have to give a person Miranda warnings if they're in police custodial interrogation. And there's a lot of discussion about whether or not she was under police custodial interrogation or not. And the Supreme Court concluded that was not a proper grounds to overturn the convictions because at the point in time when she made these statements, she was not in custody and she was not being interrogated. She didn't have to stay there. And there's a lot of discussion in that, but ultimately, as was just pointed out, that's not the basis that the court took for its ruling. Yeah. So all of that custodial Miranda stuff, the court evaluated it and said there's no violation here. She didn't need to be given her Miranda rights for these statements. Now, with respect to the double jeopardy issue, most people think of double jeopardy, which also comes from the Fifth Amendment. Most people think that double jeopardy means, well, once you've been tried for a crime and you have not been found guilty, then they can't try you again for the same crime. And that's true. But a lesser form of double jeopardy occurs when they put you at peril for the same crime two or three times or multiple times in one proceeding. It's the same concern about double jeopardy. And what the Supreme Court, or what the appellate court here said was, when you charged her for four offenses and four counts arising out of these two incidences, you were in effect subjecting her to multiple punishments for the same offense. And the court said, because there were two discrete moments here, it said, we're just going to look at these instances. We're going to look at this one moment in time when she had this conversation with one detective, even if she made several misstatements during it, untruthful statements. That's just one incident. And then a discrete period of time later, she said the same things, but she said it at a different time. So we're just going to say that's two incidents, and that's it. Because if you prosecute her for more, you're in effect subjecting her to double jeopardy.
Dave, you made a comment a few minutes ago that you felt that, you know, she lied four times to four different people.
Yes. What I saw and I wrote about it was I'm scrolling through through what I wrote, and my computer is not being very cooperative at times. That she wrote, she said to four different officers, and they were listed basically in the appeal that was filed. These witnesses that she lied to. So, lie number one was to Corporal Rendon Fletcher. Stated that her daughter, she said that her daughter was missing in the custody of a nanny, and the appellant was conducting her own search. This is in the. This is what. Cheney Mason and his assistant attorney wrote. And then to Lieutenant Reginald, he was Sergeant Hosey, Reginald Hosey at the time, you know, Officer Acevedo escorted the appellant to the last stated location of the nanny. So she lied about the location of the nanny. That, and she lied to another officer at that time Hosey. You know, she led him on a wild goose chase to the Sawgrass Apartments. So that's lie number two and three. And number four was when, during a recorded statement, she said that she worked at Universal Studios. So this is when she lied to Melich. And to me, that's four different lies for four different people. But the court didn't see it that way. So,
okay. But to my mind, there's a fifth lie, and it's a big one, and that's the 911 call.
Well, that's a dispatcher. That doesn't count because a dispatcher is not a a law enforcement officer. In other words, it's the same thing with George Zimmerman when the dispatcher said, "Are you following him? Okay, we don't need you to do that." They're not sworn in. You can say anything. I called the Seminole County dispatcher, emergency number, non-emergency, and discussed it with the manager, the superintendent, and she told me that we don't have any jurisdiction. We don't have any real authority. We can advise you. That's all we can do. So in case he lied to the 911 operator, she wasn't lying to a law enforcement officer.
Okay, Peter, is it not a a criminal act to call 911 and give incorrect information?
I think in many jurisdictions that probably constitutes an offense of one type or another, and there are probably different ways it could be perceived as a violation of some form of criminal law. It probably wouldn't be per se a violation of laws which make it a crime to give false information to a law enforcement officer, as Donald just discussed. But there are other forms of laws that prohibit that kind of behavior. So the short answer to your question is it probably is some type of violation. With respect to the Casey Anthony case, that may or may not have been a violation of a Florida statute, but on the appeal, there were only four counts that were at issue. These were the four counts that she was found guilty of. I don't know how many other counts were brought. I don't know which ones the jury declined to find guilt on. But once the jury acquits a defendant, the prosecution, and this is something that people don't fully appreciate, the prosecution has no right of appeal. So once the prosecutor loses a case at the trial court level, they have no right to appeal at all. The case is over. It's only the defendant who has the right to appeal. And since there were only four counts that she was found guilty of, those were the only four counts on appeal. We don't know anything about any of the other counts. And with respect to those four counts on appeal, those four counts only involved, according to the court that reviewed it, two separate moments in time, regardless of how many officers she was speaking to at each moment in time. So there, she may have made other lies. She may have given false information. She may have done other things. These may or may not have been subject to counts at the trial court level. But the only thing we see on the appeal are the four counts that she was found guilty of. And as we've described, those four counts ultimately, according to the court, just fell into two categories, and that's it.
Well, I would also want to say, too, to kind of help clarify things a little, that she didn't voluntarily talk to that dispatcher. Her mother pretty much put her on the phone. So I think it would be hard-pressed to even consider charging her at the time or even later on now, which I seriously doubt, because I think they're pretty much done with it, but, you know, the state of Florida. But I don't think that it would hold up a charge against that anyway, you know, lying to the dispatcher.
Yeah, and I think the prosecution, in the course of deciding what they're going to prosecute her for and what they're not going to prosecute her for, they probably make distinctions, and they probably decide, look, we're not going to get after her for making a false statement to a dispatcher. We're going to focus on these false statements to law enforcement officials.
Right.
Because when you're trying to present a case to a jury, you have to really try to make it as straightforward as possible, and you don't want to run the risk that you've got too many issues running around and there's too much confusion. Now, if you have to make these charges and make these types of arguments, you do, but if you can keep it simple, it's easier for the jury to understand, and that's usually where trial lawyers want to go, prosecutors included.
And you know what? I know we're probably going to talk about this, but before I forget it, I want to bring up that a lot of people forget that she is a convicted felon. And I think that really trumps anything with regard to these misdemeanors. So,
right. The Amy Huizenga check deal.
Check, yeah. So she's, no matter what happens here, she is still a convicted felon. And that's more important than anything else that's left.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's move on. The other Casey news is she's filed for bankruptcy. I can't remember the exact amount, but it's over $700,000. $500,000 is apparently owed to the defense team. Well, I have a big problem with this. I thought Baez was working pro bono, and after the indigency hearing, the taxpayers picked up the tab for expenses. Dave, am I right?
Yeah, my guess, and this is strictly a guess, and this is really where someone like Peter can step right in and probably resolve this issue. The total amount, first of all, is $792,119.23. She lists Jose Baez $500,000. There's $140,000 that's supposed to go to law enforcement, the sheriff's office. But let's just stick with that $500,000 for now. My guess would be that she lists Jose Baez and a slew of creditors, including all of the expert witnesses, the doctors who examined her, and so forth and so on. So, and I'm not even going to mention the, you know, Roy Kronk, the other people, Zenaida Gonzalez, the other people that are suing her for whatever amount, but that she's named in this. But I think that I haven't seen any numbers yet. She's not listed any numbers for any of these expert witnesses. The only person she's listed any amount for is Jose Baez. And what major question I have right now is the fact that here it is a year and a half later, and nobody has written a bill. I mean, she can't. She's got an amount. She doesn't know what kind of money these people are asking for. So my guess would be that if they end up billing Jose Baez, that's for that $500,000. That's like a superfluous number that will cover all expenses just in case Kobolinsky, if Henry Lee, if they all say, look, we can't get any money out of this person, so we're going to go after Jose Baez. He's the one who really hired us. And then Casey Anthony sits there and says, well, you know what? I can't pay Jose Baez either. Therefore, I'm just going to put up that number of $500,000, and that covers everybody.
But Dave, I mean, we went through the indigency hearing, and, Jose's expenses were covered.
Well,
Simon,
I
think you have to distinguish between, in rendering legal services, there's always two charges. And one charge are the fees. Fees, F-E-E-S, are basically the salary paid to the attorney for the attorney's time, for his services, for his knowledge, etc. The lawyer charges a fee. The fee can be a flat fee. You can say, you know, my fee for this is $500,000, or in civil cases, it can be, you know, X dollars an hour, you know, $300, $400, $500 an hour. These fees are, In a sense, the attorney's labor cost or wage cost. It's what the attorney charges. Separate and independent of fees are things like expenses and costs. When you are involved in a lawsuit, there are filing fees, there are jury fees, and even though I'm calling these fees, these are really treated as expenses. You have to pay the court money to file documents. You have to put jury deposits in place, nominal amounts, a few hundred dollars for jury fees. You have to pay court reporters for transcripts. There are all these costs associated with it. Costs are usually they're not small, but they're small in comparison to fees. The fees of the lawyers are usually much greater than the costs, but the costs can be considerable. Now, what I think happened in this indigency hearing is that the court gave her breaks with respect to costs that a litigant would normally be responsible for paying, but they're not going to charge that in situations like this, in a defense, et cetera. Now, the fees are a completely different issue, and I don't doubt that at some level Baez and his colleagues will be able to generate $500,000 in fees, whether by hourly timesheets or, I suspect, in the case of a criminal matter, just some agreement that they're going to be paid X dollars. I don't know, but a case like this, in my opinion, could easily generate that kind of fee. I don't think there was ever any real expectation that he would be paid the fee. That's what I suspect.
So, okay, but here's the big problem I have. It was all over the news that he was working pro bono.
And now, I was in the courtroom that day, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, doesn't that mean that there are no fees?
Well, I have a question, too, before you answer, Peter. I mean, because I know that there were issues over billing. For example, a court reporter's fee where they charged Baez, because Baez had to take all these invoices and turn them over to the JAC, which is Florida's Justice Administration Commission. They were the ones that paid the bills when she was found indigent. Okay, so everything had to be submitted to the JAC. And the JAC would sit there and say, look, we're not paying these people, $1,800 for this service. We'll pay them $1,200. Okay,
yeah.
So I guess in that respect, it was up to Jose Baez to work out a deal, or could he then subsequently be billed that difference? And
well,
he could
turn. That's a very good point, and I suspect that that may be where a lot of these charges come from. Because, in effect, what could be happening is Baez is engaging experts, and these experts charge certain fees for their services. In the parlance that I've just discussed, the experts' fees are considered, quote-unquote, costs, and the client is always responsible for these costs, but the experts won't work on a promise to pay by the client because that's not the way they do business. They strike up a deal always with the attorney, and they have an agreement with the attorney, and they say to the attorney, look, I'm happy to work with you. You're the one hiring me to serve as an expert on your case, but I'm not going to count on your client paying me, even though it's ultimately her responsibility. You have to pay me, and then it's your responsibility to get the money from the client. Now, if all of these Baez bills that are set forth in the bankruptcy are in effect these types of costs, if they are these types of costs, costs in excess that the public wouldn't pay for, costs that Baez necessarily incurred to retain these experts, then that's not inconsistent with him saying he's working pro bono. He could be working completely pro bono, not charging her any fees, and he could still be racking up these huge costs, and
well,
he's got to pay those.
That's basically what happened.
Yeah, I think
that's what happened. Because the state did say, we're not paying you. We're not paying you, Jose. We're not paying you, Janie Mason, for services rendered.
Yeah,
you
know, no, I don't know
you
enough.
For your work.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the details of the relationship here, but if I was going to try to reconcile all of this information, if Baez is saying I'm working pro bono and $500,000 in fees are generated and submitted to the bankruptcy court, then, quote-unquote, these fees are really just costs paid to experts and things like that, and Baez has to pay them. And the law provides that it's ultimately the client is responsible for these costs. It's still a little bit of it's still a little misleading because I don't think anyone ever expected that Casey would ever be able to pay these costs. But nevertheless, she is legally responsible for them. They probably are legally her debt, even though I don't think anybody expects her to pay them. And even if you take issue with the $500,000 that constitute the biggest chunk of her bankruptcy claim, there still appears to be another $200,000 or so out there, and I don't think she has two pennies to rub together. And she's insolvent and bankrupt whether you include the $500,000 or not.
I agree with that. You know, I don't have any sympathy for her, but I agree with you.
Yeah, so, you know, she's going to get a bankruptcy discharge. A Chapter 7, which is what she's filed, is just basically a straight-up liquidation. An individual walks into bankruptcy court and they say, look, my bills are enormous. My assets are little or no assets. I'm going belly up. I need a fresh start. And she'll probably get it.
Which begs the question, then the next question is what happens after that if somebody wants to refile a lawsuit that's been already discharged? She sells a book or something later on. Wouldn't you have asked that one, Simon? I mean, that one kind of leads to that. I didn't mean to take anything away from you, but, you know, I'm getting old and I forget these things if I don't say it right away.
Well, it's interesting. The bankruptcy laws tend to be very forgiving in terms of debtors. There are some exceptions, but the general rule is that the debtor is entitled to what we call a fresh start. And in a Chapter 7 liquidation, the debtor comes in and cashes out. They basically say, I don't have much, and this is what I've got. And the debts, the unsecured debts, are basically extinguished, and the creditors take nothing, and that's just the way it works.
And that's
people
the
think,
end of it?
Well, basically, that's the end of it. Now, you raised the question, for instance, right now there's a defamation lawsuit that's pending against her. I guess that was brought by her nanny. And
not really, but yeah, you know, the person has the same name, but similar name,
well,
not even identical.
You see, what's going on in a case like Casey Anthony, and we might as well talk about it, is a lot of this litigation isn't really driven by the clients themselves. It's driven by attorneys. If Baez is stepping in and he's paying $500,000 in costs to represent Casey Anthony, and he knows he's not going to get paid, that just begs the question, why would he do that? And one answer is the case brings with it a lot of celebrity, a lot of publicity. And if you tell me that the nanny isn't really suing for defamation, even though she's the plaintiff, that suggests that somebody is encouraging her to sue. And one possible explanation for that could be the fact that there are lawyers out there who say, look, this is a public case. This is a publicity case. We have a claim for defamation. Nanny, let me represent you. I'll sue. You're not going to pay a nickel. I'll deal with everything, and I'll be your lawyer. And then the lawyer runs around and gets on the radio and the TV, and it's publicity. Now, I'm not saying that that's definitely what's happening, but it's an explanation.
Yes.
It's a good explanation. But my question is, The two seemingly unconnected developments, what happened with the appellate court and the bankruptcy, can it possibly affect the Zenaida Gonsalves case?
Well, it's an interesting question, and let's just talk about it for a second. First of all, one of the exceptions to getting what we call a bankruptcy discharge, there's no doubt that the Zenaida case is what we call a claim. It's a claim for money against Casey Anthony. It's basically an alleged debt. And it's based on the theory that Casey fraudulently lied about Zenaida and defamed her, and that Zenaida suffered damages as a result of the defamation. I'm not sure the case has any great merit because one of the defenses, one of the arguments about defamation is lies have been told about you, and how have you been damaged by them? And I'm just not clear on exactly what the nature of the lies are that Casey alleges to have uttered. But it is possible that if it is concluded that she maliciously lied and she doesn't have a defense in terms of a privilege, that this was the result of fraud, then it's possible this debt could be accepted, meaning it doesn't get discharged in bankruptcy. It's not discharged. But the bankruptcy courts tend to bend over backwards to try to get a discharge, so usually it's a pretty strong showing. I would need to know
you think that it would have to be a really strong case against her then in order for the bankruptcy court to intervene on Zenaida's behalf in this case? Because, I mean, for one thing I can tell you is that when it was filed against the defamation suit was filed, the attorney listed her name as Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez, which is the name that Casey gave. But in fact, this woman was never Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez. She's just Zenaida Gonzalez. So one way or the other, whatever happens, my question would be, would there be enough proof would it have to be a lot of proof for the bankruptcy court to step in?
Well, the bankruptcy court, this is what happens in the bankruptcy court. This claim is listed somewhere in the schedules that the debtor files. The debtor files And I think you have a copy of the petition there, but there are a bunch of schedules that are included. And the schedules basically ask the debtor to list all the claims being made against her, whether they be debts or lawsuits or what have you. And this claim, this defamation lawsuit, is included in somewhere it's included in the list of claims that are being made against Casey, or it should be included.
Yeah, so, I got to scroll all the way to the bottom here.
Okay, well, there should be some reference to it somewhere, because obviously this is a debt
there
that
is.
Casey wants. Okay. So Casey's basically saying, and I want to get rid of this lawsuit too. Now, the minute a debtor files for bankruptcy, there's something that takes place called an automatic stay. The bankruptcy court says, okay, that's it. The debtor's walked into my court. I own this case. I own every asset. I own every liability. Nobody does anything with this debtor unless they talk to me first. That's it. It's like I always think of it as a great big glass bowl. It just sits down over the debtor. So now, if the people pursuing the defamation claim want to proceed with the defamation claim in state court, they have to go to bankruptcy court and they have to say, dear judge, please let us proceed. Which is a federal court. That's correct. So they have to go to the federal court. It's usually, you know, the courthouses are always in the same area, and we say in the legal parlance, you got to go across the street to that federal court because that's the federal house, and this is just the state house. So you go across to the federal court, you set up a meeting with the judge, and you say, dear judge, we want to pursue this case. And then the bankruptcy court decides whether or not you pursue the case, whether or not you can pursue the case, and also whether or not you're going to pursue it in bankruptcy court or if you're going to pursue it in state court. And that's a whole big topic of discussion, and that's another rabbit hole. So the short answer is the bankruptcy may – it will have an impact on the defamation case. I just don't know what that impact is. I'd have to see more about it. But I suspect at the end of the day, Casey's going to get the relief that she needs because that's what usually happens. But I can't say for certain. Now – the other issue is the appeal. And, Simon raised an interesting point a while ago. We were talking about the appeal. We had four counts of misdemeanor providing false information that were reduced to two counts. And if I understand correctly, Simon, the sentence that was given to her for these four counts was basically no sentence at all. You've served your time. You're guilty of four counts. You're done. But the defense appealed it anyway. And and when it was all said and done, the four counts got reduced to two counts, so it didn't really change very much. So why do it? And one theory is that while the defamation case is pending, the defendant in the defamation case, Casey, her lawyers don't want her to have to be deposed. They don't want her to have to talk. And one of the defenses you have is our old friend, the Fifth Amendment. And the Fifth Amendment says you don't have to testify against yourself if you're subject to criminal prosecution, the privilege against self-incrimination. So she doesn't have to testify in the defamation suit as long as she has a Fifth Amendment defense. And the Fifth Amendment defense, in theory, only lasts as long as there's a criminal proceeding going, at least in these types of cases. So when they took it up on appeal, they got a long sort of delay pattern. Now, I'm not suggesting
that. So these are criminal misdemeanors.
Well, they're still criminal. The law doesn't care. You don't have to. It can be a misdemeanor. It could be a felony. But as long as you're subject to criminal prosecution, you have the right not to testify. And it's the same right that gives us the Miranda warning. You have the right to remain silent. So as long as she had a potential specter of criminal prosecution, and you know, it's possible that the appellate court could have, instead of just reducing the criminal counts, it could have said no. We're going to remand this whole thing back to the trial court. We want you to retry these criminal issues because you got something wrong. That's called a remand. Now, that's not what happened here, but that could have happened. And because that could have happened, she still had the potential of being subject to criminal prosecution, and she still had a Fifth Amendment right. Now, the Fifth Amendment right appears to have been dissipated because now she's no longer subject to criminal prosecution that I'm aware of. But
the defense
is going
to appeal that again, all the way probably to the Florida Supreme Court, they said.
Right. So
but eventually it'll be resolved.
Eventually it'll be resolved. So I don't know what the status of it is now, but this is one explanation for why they would take it up on appeal, because in effect it preserves her Fifth Amendment right, and she doesn't have to be deposed in the defamation case. Now, I don't know where that's going to go now. I suspect that the plaintiff in the defamation case is going to try to take her deposition, and they're going to serve a notice, and they say, come on in for your deposition, and then there may be some other objection, and her lawyers may try something else to get her out of it, so to speak.
Well, tell me if I'm wrong here, Dave, haven't Zinaida's lawyers tried several times to take her deposition?
Well, they tried to find her. They finally found her, and I had found out where she lived and wrote about it. But Zinaida's defense team already knew that. But I know that the Morgan and Morgan law firm, and I like John Morgan. I mean, I've known him for years, not intimately. I mean, I know him when I see him and talk to him. He's a nice guy, but I think that he's got very deep pockets. So, no matter what happens, as much as Cheney Mason continues this case all the way to the Supreme Court, appealing, whatever, John Morgan's deep pockets are going to keep him right along with it. And the bottom line is not just this so-called justice for Zinaida, which I think is really more of he wants to put Stacey on the stand where she's got to answer what happened to her daughter. What happened to your daughter? And make her answer that question. I think that was it all along. And if they get a victory for Zinaida, that's great. But in the end, they can put Stacey on the stand.
You know, I don't know enough about all the facts here, but, you know, from my perspective, it just seems like this is all a lot of needless, wasteful litigation driven by, I hate to say it, by attorneys who just want press. And I'm sure that technically Zinaida was probably harmed by or was probably the subject of false statements made by Casey, but I don't think anybody took those statements seriously, and I think by the end of the day it was pretty clear that the statements were false. So, you know, I don't see a lot of harm to Zinaida. I can see there's potential per se defamation, but, you know, to me it's just, you know, I don't see how you're ever going to collect the money anyway.
No.
To me I don't really see
a lot of damage here, because she was, you know, I hate to say it, but she was kind of damaged coming into it. I think this is basically, I know how much people hate Casey and they want justice for Zinaida, but it's all through, you know, getting at Casey. I don't think that, for one thing, she didn't name that particular person. When she was shown a picture of that particular woman, she said, no, that's not Zinaida. So,
you know, I think
she did go to the same apartment complex, and there lies the crux of it, that she happened to innocently show up to look at that apartment the day before, I believe, Casey mentioned Zinaida Gonzalez living at that apartment complex.
Yeah. Well, from what I read in the appellate court opinion, it seemed as if Casey was basically scrambling and trying to protect herself, and she was trying to suggest that the child, that Zinaida had done something with the child. And, you know, this was typical scrambling by a person accused of a crime, not to come out and accuse someone else of doing anything, but to try to get people to stop focusing on her. And I think that's, at the end of the day, that's what everybody perceives it to be. And I think that's what it was. And I don't think anybody thinks that Zinaida was really truly harmed by this. It may still be defamatory per se, but I don't think anybody thinks that Zinaida was really seriously harmed.
Oh, okay. Let me change gears here. Dave, did you see the interesting article on the Examiner that launched earlier today?
No, I haven't seen it. And if you have the link, you know, if you know where it is, I'd be more than happy to I imagine I could probably just right now go to examiner.com and find it.
Well, let me read you a quote. Something was put up on Craigslist, and it reads, "I am a national media investigative reporter who lives in Cocoa Beach. Casey Anthony is living in the Ocean Woods gated community in Cape Canaveral. I'm offering as much as $50,000 to anyone who can deliver the actual address to me or any sources that have been eyewitnesses to her whereabouts and or activities here. I am particularly interested in eyewitness accounts of the incident that happened at the Sandbar restaurant recently."
Well, no, I gotta find that. And I imagine it's probably in the local, somewhere here in the local, but where on Craigslist, I don't know where to look for it. But
I'll send you the link. But you know, here's my question. You know where she is. Is this guy even close?
Yeah, so she lives in Cape Canaveral. There's nothing really secretive about that any longer. It's a gated community. Basically, what I know is that her father is there all the time. Her father was instrumental in supporting her inside that place. And to me, it reeks of George knowing about this setup in the you know, before the trial began. But that's a whole different story. But she likes the bars over in the Cocoa Beach, Canaveral, and in particular the Port Canaveral area. So, yeah, she's over there. And I've had several investigative journalists come to me and ask me questions. I have a source, and you know, who gave the information to me, who refuses to talk to anybody else. She wants nothing to do with it. She spotted her inside this place with the big sunglasses, the wigs, the, you know, walking her little dog, and, you know, the maintenance guy in there offers up dog treats to all the people with their animals in there, and he noticed that this particular person never looks him in the eye. He's always polite and thanks him, but wondered why this person never looked him in the eye. So, it's definitely Casey in there. But she hasn't spotted the bars, by the way. She hasn't spotted, but nobody really cares. To be honest with you, they're all basically like, well, you know, we think it's her. Yeah, I've seen her. But they're all sitting on a bar stool. What do they care?
Here's my big question. Why doesn't she just disappear into the night?
Where will she go?
Well, good question.
You know, that's the problem.
I mean,
she's got a miserable life.
Right, but isn't it time that, you know, she just sort of got herself out of the media?
She's asking for it. I mean, I have no sympathy for this woman whatsoever, and she deserves everything that she gets. But, you know, she'd have to move to, like, Zanzibar or somewhere out in the Sahara Desert to go incognito. People are out there, you know, I mean, I know that she spent the Christmas holidays down at a condo in Cocoa Beach, that area. Owned by a family friend from Ohio. We call them snowbirds, basically. But she spent that time there, and one of the local media trucks parked outside and followed her back to her gated community. Meanwhile, she calls 911. Of all people to call 911, and says, look, I'm being harassed. So by the time she got into her gated community, punched the code in, the TV truck was right behind her, and as she went in, so did that truck. But right behind that truck was a squad car. And in it went and then warned them that they are trespassing on this private property. You need to leave right now or we're going to arrest you. So as far as I know, she's been left alone since that time. So, I don't know. Is she asking for it or it's just the nature of the beast? She's one of those problems that the Examiner and the Inquirer and people like that, they just don't want her to go away. There's an audience. There's people out there.
Peter, you have a long and industrious history with O.J. Simpson.
Well, I have a history. Beyond that, I don't know. My history would probably bore most people. But, you know, one of the things that strikes me about this is that I was talking earlier about, you know, lawyers liking the limelight. And I also believe to a certain extent, I believe that everybody at some level can fall prey to craving or wanting the limelight. We're human. We all do it. Or we're all susceptible to it, I should say. And it's frequently the case that many people who are, let's just consider actors and actresses and people who want to be popular, they want to be famous. So they spend their whole lives trying to be famous, and they spend their whole lives trying to be on TV and television and advertisements, etc. And then they get to be really popular and famous, and then they say, oh, please leave me alone, leave me alone. You're bothering me. You're following me. There's too many paparazzi. And, you know, at a certain level, these people are sort of they're conflicted. On the one hand, they want the stardom. On the other hand, they say they don't. And if you take the stardom away from them, then I think they go into withdrawal and they want it again. In the case of Casey Anthony, I just don't know enough about her to say whether or not she really wants to be in the limelight or whether or not she really wants to be out of the limelight. I get the feeling with her there's a bit of a sense of melodrama, and she, at some level, craves and wants this attention. But I could be wrong about that. I also think at many other levels, she probably does what she can to try to avoid it. But as was just pointed out, people don't leave her alone. They follow her. So I don't know what's going on in her mind. I suspect there'll come a day in the not-too-distant future when nobody cares about her anymore. And then she's going to do something to try to get the attention back, because I suspect she may find that she misses it.
Dave, do you think that you know, she is seeking fame and fortune or not?
I think that she's had her fame. I don't think she's looking for fame. I think she would certainly go after a fortune if she could, but I think she also knows at the end of the day that nobody wants to pay her. You know, she's a pariah. She's the most hated woman in the world. So, and that's got to grind at her. Not, like I said, that I have any sympathy for that, but I'm just saying that I don't think that anyone who went through, knowing that she's the most hated person in the world, that she would be looking for any sort of publicity at this point. I don't think she's ever going to write a book, because she knows that it would be wasted time and effort, because she's not going to get paid. Like Jose Baez's book is not a bestseller like Jeff Ashton's. There's reasons for that. So, you know, I think Casey's just a waste, basically, and I think she realizes it.
We're just about out of time for the program. Peter, would you like to give us your parting salvo?
Well, I really appreciated Dave's insight and comments on all this, and I appreciate every the opportunity to talk about this stuff. It's interesting. I always think with someone like Casey Anthony, I have this horrible feeling that 2 or 3 years from now, they'll pay her $1 million or $500,000 to do a Playboy centerfold, and she'll jump at the opportunity to do it. That's where I see people like her ending up. But who knows? Who knows? I think for the most part, this case is going to die down and go away, but it never ceases to amaze me how charged these types of cases are and how people are always drawn to them, and they captivate our attention for a while, and then they go away, and we get a new thing that captivates our attention.
And Dave, your thoughts?
Well, I guess in the end, we still hear about who is it, the one that did the 40 wax, what's her name?
Lizzie Borden.
You know, I think that while Casey may fade her, you know, somewhat, I think her glory has faded ever since the trial ended. I think that for the most part, her glory, whether that was good glory, good news, good bad news, whatever, has kind of gone by the wayside. But I think that this story will perpetuate. This story will live on, just like we still hear about Lizzie Borden. I think that 100 years from now, people will remember who Casey Anthony was. So, but what she does day to day now, I don't know. I mean, I did open that Craigslist page. It's on the Space Coast, and someone has sent me information on that once, and I think it's legit. But you know what? If she's still in the news, but I don't think she's the one that's making the news. I think it's like just like Peter said with the attorneys that are going after defamation or whatever, they're the ones that are doing it. They're the ones that are putting these clients up to the up to it, and I think the news is putting Casey up to it.
Yeah, I have to agree. Gentlemen, it is.
And thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure.
It is time to call a halt to the proceedings. I want to thank you both for taking time to talk to me today. It's been great. I wanted the pair of you. Peter, your insights into the legal system are always wonderful, and Dave, I can't think of anyone that knows more about the Casey Anthony saga than you. So my sincere thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Simon, very much for inviting me.
Until next time, and this is Simon Barrett, wishing everyone a happy, safe, and a pleasant day. We'll be back again soon. Till next time, goodbye.